Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. I am so excited. It's not raining. The sun is shining. It's a beautiful day. But we intend to make sure that it gets a little darker around you because you're going to get scared just a trifle when you hear about this book that is absolutely more than five stars. When a correctional officer climbs to the top of his watchtower and opens fire on the inmates and guards, federal investigator Marcus Williams and serial killer, he's one of my favorite, Francis Ackerman Jr. must join forces again to unearth the truth behind the incident. What they find is a serial killer using the prison as his hunting grounds. But the Judith killer's ambitions don't end with a few murders. He wants to go down in history and has no reason left to live. I'm not going to tell you anymore, but the author is here. Ethan Cross is here. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good morning. That is so good. Now, this is scary, and it's about a prison system. That does this one really exist, or did you make this up, and how did you make it up?
Yeah, it was something that I created, and really it was just something where I kind of thought to myself, you know, how could you take a prison and do things differently, and you know, kick new technology and kind of, you know, do a prison of the future kind of thing. And then obviously things go very wrong with it. But yeah, that I really enjoyed doing that kind of thing where I create not only the characters, but also, you know, come up with a cool setting or a different kind of business, something interesting that they can, you know, kind of a playground for them that is kind of different and hopefully people find interesting.
I found it very interesting, and I know the people at Partners in Crime all read it. The one thing I love about them is that they read and review every book that they get to do a tour with. They actually read them all. Show, Wendy, and Gina read everything. And then what happens is they'll just say to me, "We're putting you down for the tour, even if you don't want it." And I get them anyway. They did that this morning three times. Go like, "Did you know that you're down for this one or that one?" And I go, "No, I didn't, but now I do." I have so many books inside. And I read theirs first because if it's for a specific date, I have to read it. So tell us about Marcus and his relationship with Maggie. And what about Dilemma? First, give everybody a summary of the plot, like a small one. We don't want to give away too much of anything.
Well, I'm basically there as the Judas killer, as you kind of said in your description, is using this prison as kind of his hunting grounds. And there's kind of a deeper plot going on with this leader of the ULF, the Urban Liberation Front, which is kind of a gang leader who is pretty infamous, pretty powerful, and he happens to be a inmate here at the prison. So then it gets involved with the Shepherd organization, who is this is actually the fourth book in the Shepherd series, and the Shepherd organization is basically a kind of a no hold barred task force for hunting down serial killers. And Marcus, as you mentioned, is the team leader. And he is in a relationship with Maggie, who's another one of the members of the team. And his son, Dylan, is someone who actually just a character who actually just came in the third book in the series. He didn't know he had a son. And so now he's kind of dealing with all of that, you know, obviously that he's missed a large portion of his son's life. And also that, you know, he didn't know he had a son, and now it's kind of a big shock. And, you know, a real change into his lifestyle, and he's dealing with all that.
That's rough, no matter how you turn it. But to have the first scene was really amazing, where this prison guard just got up and shot everybody out of nowhere. How did you decide to start it like that? I said, like, oh my God, what's going to happen next? And then once you read that, you can't stop reading it. That's like, forget it. You're not going to stop at all. And that's what happens when I start reading, and then it takes me an hour and a half to read a book, seriously. I'm like, oh, okay, that's not good. Yeah, how did you create that scene? My God.
Well, I did a lot of research with, you know, prisons, and visited a couple prisons and things like that. And really, I just, you know, I liked the books. I write books that I would want to read, you know, and I have, I guess I have a short attention span. So I like books with a lot of action. But I thought that, you know, it was just a good way to kick things off. You know, that you know, it's an action book, and I don't know. It's just like I say, you know, I guess I have a short attention span. I like to keep things moving.
Well, it's an unexpected beginning. I could tell you that. People are going to read it and say, like, a prison guard decided to shoot everybody. Why would he do that? So it leads you to find out more. It leaves you to go, like, why would he do that? What are they going to do about it? What happens when they question him? And that was even scarier when you find out why. And
That's something that I love doing with books. I think Lee Child really kind of does this the best, but the unanswered question. I try to incorporate that a lot, and I think that really, you know, keeps people turning pages when there's kind of that little bit of a mystery. You know, obviously the book's a thriller, not a mystery, but you know, to keep that kind of you know, what's going on, what does that mean, what is, you know, just those kind of unanswered questions. I think really make a book interesting.
It did. I know that Cheryl read it and Gina read it, and they said, you have to read this because you're going to love it. I said, are you sure about that? And they loved it. And she said it was so scary she couldn't put it down. So when she sent it to me, she wanted to know what I thought. I said, I'm not going to tell you until you read my review, which everybody read. Yeah, my review's good. So why is Marcus so distant, and he seems so cold at times that he doesn't really get close to people? It's like he's afraid to get too close to anybody.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some things in his past, you know, where he's lost people. But also something that I'm doing with this series, and that'll really come into play in the next book, is that he'll actually receive a diagnosis as an adult of Asperger's syndrome, or technically it's autism spectrum disorder now. And that actually kind of mirrors my own experiences, because I was diagnosed as an adult with autism. And so it's kind of a funny thing, the way it worked out with this character, because, you know, I didn't initially design him. I didn't create him with this kind of disorder, but it just worked out that way, that, you know, at the time I wasn't diagnosed, and when I was creating the character and kind of putting some of you know, my own eccentricities into his you know, character, it just worked out, and now I have seen, you know, through my own experiences, and getting diagnosed, that it would be something that that I think people will find interesting with him.
It is,
and
of course.
Something for.
Well, I know people with, my nephew's autistic. He's 7, but you wouldn't know it now. He's amazing. But I know that they have to have everything in schedule, everything in order, and everything in a ritual, that he has to do everything at the same time every day or he gets thrown off. That I do know.
Yeah.
And,
and
Asperger's is a little more serious, I know that.
Well, the thing really about the spectrum is that a lot of people know someone who's on the spectrum or things like that,
yeah.
But the spectrum is so wide that it's really the old saying is if you've met one person on the spectrum, then that's all. You've met one person on the spectrum. Because the gamut is really just so wide from everything from like what you said, where everything has to be scheduled, everything, you know. I know some people who, you know, their food has to be a certain way and all that kind of things like that, you know. But, you know, really, you can't even take those certain things and apply them to everyone. And then where it really gets interesting is when you get people who are like myself, who through our whole lives and didn't know that we had this and have developed coping mechanisms. And so you wouldn't know a lot of the things, and they're more internal, you know, they don't really manifest themselves outwardly as much.
That's true. So we've got three characters here that are quite interesting. We've got my favorite character, Francis Ackerman Jr., got to tell us about him. He's scary. I mean, just the way you described him, I could picture him and go like, oh, my God, I wouldn't want to be standing in front of him. He's scary. And he gets involved with everything. Then there's Judith, and then there's the demon. And then there's a guy in the prison, Leonard Lash, that's running it all. How did you create all of that and intertwine them into one plot? That was, like, unbelievable. What happened? I don't know. Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I couldn't hear you before. I don't know what happened.
okay.
I don't know. We went into mute or something. Who is Judith? Who is Demon? And who is Francis Ackerman? And how did you intertwine all of them? And who is Leonard Lash? He's the one that runs the prison. So everybody's afraid of him, too. They're afraid of all of these people.
they're all some pretty bad guys. Well, Judas and Demon and Lash all kind of connect together because, like I said earlier, Leonard Lash is a kind of a infamous gang leader, and Demon, this serial killer character, he kind of runs a group of killers for hire, basically kind of a mercenary group, and Judas is his apprentice, and so he actually gets involved because things aren't going the way that they should, and so he takes a personal role. And I really like the character of Demon, and he's going to be one that is going to be coming back in further installments.
Oh, good. I thought he was. I knew he weren't. He wasn't done yet. I knew he wasn't done yet.
Yeah, no. The first thing of the next book will be his escape, the first chapter.
Oh, cool.
So he's going to come back and play a major role. And the thing that I thought was that I like about him is he actually has schizophrenia. And so obviously since you've read the book, you know, it's a pretty, pretty bad case of schizophrenia, pretty severe, where he sees a lot of
you know, delusions and things that aren't real, and it kind of it's interesting where he has these problems, but he can still function with them. You know, he's learned those kind of coping mechanisms. But I always am looking for different ways where, you know, where it's not just the same kind of characters, you know, it's not just the same kind of thing, you know, to where you can have a character and or where you're looking through that character's eyes and they see the world in a really different kind of way.
Yeah, he's scary. He sees it in a very different way. I know. As a matter of fact, when the guard kills the four residents, they call them residents, like they are in a housing complex, in the prison, mm-hmm. and he takes them out. Why does he say, "I have no choice"? That was like, oh my God, you did it because you were told you had to do it. You had no choice to do it. He just did it.
Mm-hmm.
That was scary. You know, we're not going to tell anybody why, but he's scary. So you included the diary of Judith. So you got to know him and hear his voice firsthand. How come you decided to do that? That was really interesting because you actually got to hear this man speak.
Yeah, I thought that was a cool way to go back. Well, and as you know, you don't really know who the Judas killer is in the book. And so it's kind of a way to get his past in there and to tell his story, but also it kind of intertwines with the current story of what's going on. I thought it would be a cool kind of different way to really get into that killer's head, and something I hadn't done before. But I thought it turned out pretty nice.
No, that was interesting because you get to hear his voice and you get to figure out, do you like him, do you hate him? The bad characters are so good in this book. You can't hate them. So why Demon is evil, but who is Legion? Those are his imaginary people that he thinks exist. And they go like, took me a minute. I go like, huh? So those are the people that he thinks is running his life. I mean, that was really scary. I go, no wonder. Oh, my God. How did you describe them? My God.
Well, it's actually, you know, I had done quite a bit of research into people with schizophrenia, and I wanted to look at someone who was, you know, kind of undiagnosed, untreated schizophrenic. And, you know, people with schizophrenia, you know, see these things. They hear voices that are telling them, you know, calling them names and telling them to do stuff and all these kind of things. And with Demon, he's kind of, it's kind of a whole nother level where he believes that he's, you know, almost possessed by all these different demonic spirits. And really, you know, it kind of leaves it up to your imagination in the book of whether or not he really is, you know, of whether or not there really is some kind of evil force at play. But obviously with the schizophrenia, he's, you know, imagining a lot of that. But I just kind of wanted to take this character who kind of builds some sympathy for him, because he heard when you experience the world through his eyes and you see, you know, all the bombardment and all the negativity and the things coming from these delusions, you know, he really, when you look back at him when he was younger and a boy, having to go through all that, you know, I think it really kind of, you know, makes you empathize
with his struggle.
Well, you sort of empathize with all of them in a sense, too. Of course, you have Marcus, and now tell us about Powell. He's the guy that runs the prison. And he's one person that, you know, respects Marcus or whatever, and then there's Maggie, and then there's the director. And all of them together have, you know, pests that we should hear about. But also when they want Ackerman to work with them, the director would like to just put him to death and get rid of him, and that would spoil the whole book. Seriously, that would spoil the whole book.
Ackerman is definitely an interesting character. That I know you haven't read the other three in the books in the series, right? You've only,
you have to send them to me so I can read them and add them to my pile of 90 inside. So I get to know them better.
Yep, we'll have to get you those. But the evolution of Ackerman through the series has actually been really interesting. He started out as, in the first book, was actually the villain. And then he has kind of evolved into sort of an anti-hero, you know. This killer who has no fear. You know, his father was a sadistic scientist kind of guy, psychiatrist, and he actually damaged his brain to where Ackerman, he doesn't experience fear like a normal person does. And so that's a really interesting thing to play with. He was actually the character in the first book. I had intended to kill him several times, and he's just a good example of a character really taking on a life of its own, and really, you know, kind of blazing his own path, you know, because like I say, I mean, he was intended to, he was the villain, and then he was going to be killed, and then, you know, I liked him, didn't want to kill him off yet, and then he was going to be kind of an overarching villain, and then it kind of just, he just kept evolving and evolving until he ended up being to where, you know, now people, he's so many people's favorite character. In fact, the books are published over in Germany. Well, they're in about 30 different countries, but in Germany, have done really well. This book actually just came out there and hit number 2 on their Spiegel list, which is the equivalent of the New York Times for them.
Oh, nice.
So it's done really well there. But actually over there, they call it the Francis Ackerman series. Like, it's the Ackerman series, not the Shepherd series. So it's kind of thing, you know, that here's this character that's kind of taken over the series and wasn't even supposed to live past the first book. Let's see, what else did you mention
you
in
got,
your question?
You got some accolades on the back cover from some of my favorite people that I know. John Land and I are good friends, and he's going to be on a panel show in 2 weeks, but he's going to be interviewing with me on January 19th. We're going to talk to him and Heather Graham for his new book, The Rising, did together. And John Land says, the best book of its kind since Thomas Harris retired Hannibal Lecter, Cat and Mouse Game Extraordinaire. That's big from John Land. But my other author that's going to be on a panel show with David Morrell and John is a fast-paced, all-too-real thriller with a villain right out of James Patterson and Criminal Minds, and that was Andrew Gross. That's it. And that's big. Well, he's great. He's coming on for I do panel shows ever so often, and I'm going to have to get you to be on one of them. You never know what we're going to talk about. We're doing narrative, we're doing voice and point of view, and on that one we're doing mood and tone, and I have some other things. I think I'm going to do one on characters, if they could speak to the audience, describe themselves, and how they would have liked to have been created other than the way the author created them. It's just my little way of doing something different. So we have Lisa Spinelli. So why does the demon go after her? I mean, really, he went after everybody. You got to be careful with this guy. Just when you think you're safe, you're not. I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Lisa is kind of, this computer person who's the kind of tech person in charge of the prison. He really kind of interesting the way that he plays with her, because it's not he could have just killed her. But instead of doing that, he wanted to leave her alive and make her fear him, and to where he controls her for his own means entirely through fear, and that's obviously, he has to be a pretty scary guy to do that.
Yeah, he is a pretty scary guy to do that. And I can imagine him and Ackerman working together. That would be even scarier. Oh, my God. Seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is. He's scary. But Marcus is Ackerman's brother, isn't he? He's related to him in some way. So Marcus insists that he's his brother. That's scarier. It's even scarier. And Marcus insists that he become part of the team as long as he doesn't kill anybody and hurt them. But, that's not going to happen, because they're going to go after him anyway. So why did he want him on the team? And I don't blame him, because he was a good, more than just a backup guy. When somebody couldn't do it, he did it. That's even more interesting.
Yeah. It kind of evolved in the last book, where they actually, in the third book in the series, Father of Fear, Marcus and Ackerman actually go after their father, who is a really bad guy. And so over the course of that, Ackerman really kind of proved himself and really, showed that he can be an asset and that his skills can actually be put to use. Marcus doesn't have any family. His parents were murdered when he was young, and he really doesn't have anyone other than the Shepherd team. And so when his brother comes into his life, he really just wants to keep him close and to help him. I think he sees Ackerman as this sort of tragic character that a lot of bad things have happened to him, and really it has no fault of his own, just because of his father.
That's scary. But he's so good at what he does, and when he comes up against a group that want to hurt him, whatever, the way he gets around it is amazing. I mean, he's just like one huge brick wall, and you can't get through him. And I wouldn't mind him as a bodyguard, to be very honest. I mean, he would probably do very well in the Secret Service to protect somebody. I don't think they'd get through him so fast.
Yeah.
Definitely. And he's evil, but...
He's a fun character. And I think a lot of that plays in with that he's not afraid. He's really... he's not afraid of anything, and so he reacts quicker than, he's not afraid of what's going to happen. He's not afraid of dying. He's not afraid of, really anything. And so he can just go out and do his thing, and, and he's been locked up for years, and, has studied a lot of martial arts techniques and all kinds of things like that. So he's definitely a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, it's like, it can't be worse, so I can just do what I want to do when I'm not afraid. And it's this very rare kind of person that could be fearless like that. Because after a while, sometimes you just get afraid, and he never gets afraid, which is really cool. That makes him so unique and different. So what happens that lets the reader know that, okay, somebody's wife, Navarro's wife, is missing, but somebody lures him, Marcus, and Powell into the control center so that they should get him, but they must die. How did you create that scene? That's a sudden twist. And then he orchestrates something at a oh my God, it's so scary. Because he's not the only, there's Judith and Demon, and then there's Judith now. And he's going to just try to destroy Marcus and then cons him to get in there to get the wife out. And basically, Ray is in trouble anyway. It doesn't matter. So what is this sudden, how did you do that?
Judith in the story is wanting to kind of distract the investigators from what's going on, and so it's a way for them to be pulled away from the prison, and for them to be, you know, really kind of taken out of the equation so that he can do his thing. I love the games element of things. I love those situations, where you really look at something and you think, what's the worst thing that could happen here? You know, if I thought of what's the worst kind of situation I could be put in, or, you know, what's a really impossible choice? You know, I think those kind of situations are really interesting where you put somebody, a character's back to the wall and they have to, you know, really kind of fight their way out. And then you kind of see the different way that they think and that they deal with problems and things.
Well, I'm looking at page 234 and 235. This is scary, too. How did Demon get the blueprints of Foxbury? And then he sees a dead body. And then the last line on that page is, come on in, boys, the water's fine. Who is he talking to?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm saying, oh, my God, who's he talking to?
He actually at the some other inmates have stumbled upon him, and he's actually bathing in blood.
Yeah.
He's covering himself in the blood of this dead person. So, which is, you know, a little odd, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, oh my God. But, the scenes are so vividly depicted that you almost feel like you're in there with him. And in the prison with him. And this is a scary prison. And the fact that they wore these manacles or whatever on them, and then if they got too close, they got electric shocked, right? They got an electric shock. And yet, they didn't seem to care, because if they were going to do something and carry it out, they were going to do it anyway, these inmates. They didn't seem to scare them. I wouldn't. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and once the thing is about the prison, you know, it has all these systems in place to keep people from harming one another. Mm-hmm. But when what Judas does is turn that all of that on its head, and use that against the guards, you know, use that against thing, and basically is able to take control because of those systems. So, go ahead.
At one point, Powell was told by Marcus to shut everything down and just not to do that. Why? And to eliminate, you know, get rid of the prison and get everybody out. How come he wouldn't do that? He wouldn't clear the prison or anything. And of course, the director didn't want him to either.
Well, yeah, and Powell is. He's kind of pinned to this basket, you know. He's
he started this company with the idea of, you know, revolutionizing the way that prisons work and the way that we think about reforming, you know, mm-hmm. criminals. And he really feels that if they shut things down, if they do that, that will be the end. You know, that this, there will be no more company, there will be no more prison. And so he, you know, chooses to move forward and chooses to kind of put them all into that dangerous position.
Well, before I forget, because I don't want to forget and put the old glasses back on Tuesday, we have the author of The Neely Girl coming to speak with me. And on the 16th of January, we have a panel show, and I think I overdid it with six people instead of my usual four. We had Alan Topol, Alan Jacobson, David McCallop, Larry Farmer, and a few others that we're going to talk about narrative and narrative voice. Lynn McDaniels and Christina Hoag. On January 19th, the one and only Heather Graham and John Land, The Rising. On the 26th, the author of The Child's Play. And on February 2nd, I am so excited, Brian Freeman, Nightbird. And that's just some of what's coming up in my schedule that doesn't seem to have any more holes in it at all, ever. Mm-hmm. And I still have to get the book, The Concrete Smile. I haven't read it yet, on February 6th. And on February 9th, a really scary book about cardiac surgery. And I won't tell you anything about that right now, but you might think twice before you go to the hospital and have an operation after you read that book, seriously. And my picks, of course, for the month are Ethan Cross, The Judas Game, The Rising by John Land and Heather Graham, The Trapped Girl by Robert Dagoni, Nightbird, Ryan Freeman, and a new author, The Heart to Kill by Dorothy Place. It's an interesting book, and Killing Jane. Those are just some of the books that I read within the last 2 weeks. No, seriously. And I've got a whole bunch more. But I've got a whole bunch more questions coming up in my hand here. Tell us about Jerry Dunn and how he came to be part of the team, even though as a prison guard, you would not depict him as a prison guard. How did you create him? That was really clever, let me tell you. And that was one big surprise. I tell you, I go like, say, when there's something about him, and I go, oh, my God, wow. We won't say anything because the ending is going to shock readers as it was, and they're going to want to read all the books for real. So how did you create Jerry Dunn, and how did he come to be part of the team?
Well, as you said, he's kind of not your typical prison guard. You know, he's has a limp and a stutter, and, you know, he's not a very commanding kind of presence, but as you said, we kind of find out over the course of the story that there's more to meet the eye than for Jerry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was actually kind of a different book for me, because this is the first book that I've written where you don't know who the killer is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Judas killer really kind of remains a mystery as to who it is, and there are several kind of possibilities for who that could be, and Jerry Dunn is one of them. So, you know, it was kind of a different take. You know, in my other books that I've done, you get to know the killer. You know, you know who the killer is. You know, obviously the police don't, but you know, you see the killer through the killer's eyes and kind of travel with him. And you do in this book as well, but you don't actually know who he is. And so because of that, there were several different characters who, you know, could have been. And so there were a lot of extra characters there that were created, not necessarily for that purpose, but, you know, kind of trying to play up that mystery.
Yeah, it did. And he's like, comes in, then he comes out, and I go, oh my God, just who is this guy? And just the physical description of him makes you wonder, why is he a prison guard and how is he able to do this? And he insisted that he could handle the job. But
mm-hmm.
that's for anybody to find out. So when things come to a boiling head at the end of the novel, how did you create those final 10 scenes? And Judas himself has a couple of pseudonyms, so you really don't know who he is. You really don't know who they have met that could be him. You're not sure, which is really good.
Mm-hmm.
So when the things come to an end, how did you create those last couple of scenes where they sort of all face all the killers?
It just kind of a lot of times the endings just kind of flow together for me. You know, you've kind of set everything in motion, mm-hmm. and then you just kind of take things out to their logical conclusion. I think the ending where there's not to give too much away, but you know, Judas and Demon are at odds, even though they're you know, kind of a mentor apprentice relationship. There's something that's happened that has driven a pretty big wedge between them, and the last scene there, where he turns the tables on Demon. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah,
the way that it worked out, and that Judas sets it up in a way that, you know, it's really the only way that he could get back at this kind of, you know, really imposing, larger than life character of Demon. You know, there's not many ways you can hurt somebody like that, but you know, he finds a way.
Yeah, he does find a way, but it's like I would wonder, seriously, don't want to give any more away, if Demon and Ackerman and Judas could talk to the audience, could talk to the readers, what would they say? Would be there. Well, who do they think would be? Who do you think would be more powerful? What would they say?
Well, yeah, I think that would definitely be a fight to see. And with Demon and Ackerman, like I say, that there's going to be a drawn out hunt. You know, and kind of a battle of wits between the two of those. Because the next book actually deals with another killer who works for Demon, and they're trying to track him back through this killer to find this killer, and then hopefully that will be an opening into Demon's kind of network. But yeah, this killer in the next book is called the Gladiator. And so Ackerman has to go up against him. And I think that'll be an interesting, an interesting battle, because the Gladiator is actually a character that can physically oppose Ackerman. And so that'll be an interesting kind of development, because he really doesn't have a lot of people that have physically gladiator will.
Well, I like Ackerman, so he can't possibly lose. I'm sorry, can't, no. as a matter of fact, I'm saying he's helping them so much, why don't they just make him a prison guard and forget about whoever he killed? Because you start to like him so much that you want to identify with him. Like, I wouldn't mind. I get scared looking at him, but if he's on your side, well, what the heck? And he does everything in his power to help Marcus. Everything. I mean, I don't know if it's just because it's his brother or because he feels obligated or he wants to. But when he tells him, please don't beat up anybody and kill him, you know that's not going to happen. That was hilarious. They're like, yeah, that's not going to happen. It was funny. We have about 10 more minutes, and I'm looking here. So this is a novel of power, revenge, retribution, and hate. And why these issues and the challenge to this prison system in every single way? What did you decide to call them residents? And will the residents ever win over the other people? That would be really cool. They take over the prison. My God. Actually, they try to.
Yeah, well, the reason they were called residents, as I had kind of mentioned, Powell, the one who has started this prison, he kind of wants to, not only is there the technology that is changing things, but he also has kind of wanted to make the prison more of a community, you know, to where these men who are living in this, you know, the inmates in this prison, you know, to where they can actually almost have a sense of a little bit more normalcy and a little bit more freedom because of the technology that's involved. And so the reason they call them residents is to kind of get over that stigma of, okay, they're inmates. You know, it's just, it's all psychological. There's a lot of little psychological things that I tried to put in there that if, you know, this character of Powell looking at the way that prisons currently are and the way that prisons currently work and, you know, trying to find a different way, to find a better way.
I'm looking at the book again, and I'll tell you, this is like, I think I have some of this memorized already. So you've got Demon on page 338 and Judas together in the same place. And he says, in any case, they will hunt you and destroy you, and I'm just going to provide them with the files to kill his network. And we all know that. How does he come up against him and just say, I've betrayed you to your enemies and to your greatest nightmare, and I've outsmarted all of them with a body count that can rival anyone. I'm the greatest ever. Why does he think that?
Judas is all about superiority. You know, he was abused a lot as a child, and he really wants to prove that he is the best, that he's the, you know, he's a little bit of an egomaniac. And so he's, you know, wants to prove that he is the best. And so he's actually, in the scene that you're talking about, he's revealed that he's basically using the Shepherd organization as purposely brought them in and is using them as a weapon against Demon. And so it wasn't enough, you know, this betrayal that Demon had orchestrated against him, you know, made him so angry. It's not enough even just to kill Demon or to do that. You know, he wants to bring down his entire world, basically. And he thinks the Shepherd organization is the way to do that.
Well, he figures he'll demoralize him, but little does he know. Because he says, Ackerman, we're discussing the Judas file, what about them, where to find them. And then there's Lisa, who found an encrypted folder. And it sort of ties it all together at the end, but we're not going to say how. But that last two pages, oh, my God. And this is the last two lines. It says, your entire story is being told by you to every generation to come. Make sure you tell a good one. And that's somebody telling it to everyone. How come you ended it like that? That was really good. I'm saying, like, is he going to bring this guy back again? And is what he wrote in the journal true? I mean, really.
Yeah, I mean I really kind of wanted to end it with on a kind of a positive note, and I really kind of thought that Judas, you know, that's the reason he's doing the journals. That's the reason he wrote the journals is because he thinks that further generations will want to study him, and so he's basically just discussing the way that our kind of digital culture is set up to where, you know, everything that we do now is recorded in some way. You know, it's something that's just very interesting to me. You know, because if you look back at your grandparents and your great grandparents and things like that, you know, there's very little evidence. You know, we can't look back at much and get to know them. You know, other than a few photographs and, you know, some second and third hand stories, we really don't know much about them. But with the way that the world is now, I mean, we could go back for a lot of people, you know, who are Facebook addicts, you know, 100 years from now, your descendants will be able to look back and find out what you had for lunch today. You know, I mean, it's kind of an interesting dynamic that we have now with you know, digital technology and just the way that we're so connected. And so I think that last kind of thing is just, you know, Judas telling people, hey, you should be aware of this. You know, you're the author of your own story.
That's true, because if anybody really thinks about it, you can delete your Facebook account, but it's still there. And your Facebook account is read by everyone. And it bothers me when people write demeaning things on there about other people, because it's seen by every country and every person all around the world. And they don't they don't realize it. And some of the things they write are really foolish. And when you tell somebody you're on vacation, that's not smart. You don't tell them that on Facebook. You might want to tell them when you come back. Yeah, it's dangerous. So before we end, where can we find out more about you, your work? And I'm probably going to do something with characters, if characters could speak to you or something similar to that, because I'm doing panel shows on literary elements. So we're going to do voice and point of view on January 30th. And I'm going to do with David Morrell, Andrew Gross, and John Land, we're going to do mood and tone, because their books lend to it. And probably sometime in April, I will do another one on characters, and I'll let you know, because that should be interesting, especially with your characters.
Yeah.
That would be great. So where can we find out more about you, and when is the next book coming out, and when am I getting it? This is really important.
Well, I'm finishing up the next book now. And so it will, I mean, I would say probably this, fall, it will be coming out. And then it's called, Only the Strong. But as far as where people can reach me, they can get on, ethancross.com, and find me there, or as we were talking about Facebook, you know, they can definitely get on Facebook or Twitter and connect with me through there. And you know, I love hearing from people, and you know, something I enjoy is talking with readers and kind of getting to know them. And I actually have a group across the world that are fans, and we kind of talk and get into depth about things, and you know, they can kind of share their feelings a little bit more you know, in depth with me, and you know, kind of even influence where the stories are headed.
That's interesting. That's interesting, yeah. But that's great. But thank you so very much. This has been fun. And I can't wait to read the next one in the fall. And The Partners in Crime, I have to tell you, they do a phenomenal book tour. And I do
yes,
all their
do.
interviews, which is even better, because I get all the good authors, I get everybody. And they just tell me, do you have a spot here? Do you have a spot there? I go like, huh? I'll figure one out. Gina, Wendy, and Cheryl are they're the best, seriously. You can't get better.
Yes,
and your books
are
out there. And they keep blogging, you know, all my reviews and all my radio shows. I think that's why I'm getting so popular out of nowhere. And MJ Network, everyone, is named after my sister, Marcia Joyce, who passed away 6 years ago. And the truth of the matter is she dared me to do a book review. And she knows I don't cook. So the first book I reviewed was a cookbook by Martha Cheeves. And after that, I just, like, snowballed. So on behalf of MJ Network and Literary Viewpoints, even this has been great. And would you be interested in doing a panel show with us in April?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah,
I will definitely get in touch with you on your website or with Regina and Partners in Crime. And everybody, the sun is shining. It's 20 degrees outside. It's freezing. It's literally freezing out there. But there's no snow, and there's not going to be any snow. So have a great day. And Ethan, thank you so much. And everyone, Happy New Year. Yeah. It's been great. Thank you. And bye.
Yes. Thank you. Bye-bye.